Yeah, so we start now with a presentation by Morten Sobotnik, our guest of honor here. We're very happy that he's here with us and that he played this fantastic concert yesterday with Alec Empire and Lilleven. And I won't introduce much because I believe your talk is really going through the evolution of your work over time. The title of the talk is The Technological Big Bang, Tape Recorders, the Transistor and the Credit Card, A Personal History. It's written there. Okay. So, yeah, welcome, Morten Sobotnik.
I forgot.
Is this on?
Yes. I forgot my other glasses, so I have to wear this to see. I'm going to take you through a rather quick tour of where I started with, not when I started in life, I'd have to go back 85 years, but when I started with, this was just far enough back, which was 57 through 59 into 1960. And obviously, we'll have to do it rather quickly. But generally, just a touch of the background of the late 50s, the second half of the 50s, the 1950s. We are not quite in the 2050s yet. I was born in 1933, so in the middle of the 50s, I was in my early 20s, mid-20s, and I was in San Francisco. I won't give you the story. It's an interesting story, but I won't give you the story how I got there. But I was in San Francisco, and I was both a clarinetist and a composer, and I was a professional clarinetist. I was playing with the San Francisco Symphony, and I was playing concertos with orchestras and traveling, doing chamber music. I was also composing music for instruments, and but it was early. I was in the early state of my career, and I had early in life. I'm just pinpointing the things that actually triggered this because I think it's important. Well, I would like to share it anyway. When I was very young, I was maybe 9 years old. For some reason, I have no idea why, I managed to get a hold of two books on Stoic philosophy, and read through, it took me a long time, but I read through the two books on Stoic philosophy and decided that the meaning in life, you know, we all want to know what the meaning is. I got it at 9 years old. And the meaning in life was, for a human being, was to discover who you are and what you're capable of and to do it the best you can and to share it with other human beings, whatever it is. That was it. So that was the decision. I didn't know what my life was. I didn't know who I was or what I was going to share, but I knew that that's what you had to do. So in the back of my mind, that was always there. And so I was playing the clarinet, and I was composing, and a lot of things happened. I was in San Francisco. And that period of time that we're talking about is several things. Oh, there's no wire here. So this is the period right here. It happened to be that the first real tape recorders came into being that we could get our hands on in 1954. And I'm talking about 1955 through 1960. The first use of the transistor in a commercial way was in this period. Up until then, and through that time, I was aware, and everybody was aware, that 99% of the population of the Earth only could hear music that was local, that your father played or that you played or someone played to you. Maybe some phonograph record would get to you that sounded like, didn't sound like real music, but you know, you get some idea of it. But basically, if literacy in music is through the ear, literacy we think of reading, but the musician reads the music, but you don't get the music from them that way. You get the music through your ear. 99% of the population was relatively musically illiterate to all the music that was possible to hear at that point, in time. Much like the book. The book, before the printing press, was, you know, you could read a book if you went to Alexandria. You know, if you travel to Egypt, you could read a book, but basically most people were illiterate. Technology, the importance of the tape recorder is that it was cheap enough to someone buy. So now we could have a recording, just like you could have a recording of music that people could get. But how do you distribute that? The machinery even to play the music was vacuum tubes, very expensive. 1958, Bank of America came out with the first credit card, and that meant that, and the transistor had come into being and a commercial object. That meant that the transmission, this is what I'm thinking back in that period of time, playing the clarinet with the San Francisco Symphony and composing music for instruments. Not only was everything going to be cheap enough for people to buy, but the Bank of America said, I'll give you this credit card, you don't even have to have money. I mean, that's what we thought. It changed the world, right? There's the transistor over there. So by 1959, it suddenly occurred to me that I was alive during the time that music would change, change the world, like the printing press changed language. And that was overwhelming. My 9-year-old idea was, I could play the clarinet, but I would talk to people and I'd say, everything is going to change. Not only is everything going to change, but in a few years, it will change because commercial people who want to sell something will take the technology and give people what they want, which will be new pianos, new Zuzaphones or whatever it is, new old things, and that's what people would go. When now, this was going to be the zero moment in a new period, a new epoch, and we could have people who didn't spend their lives from 5 years old to 20 years old, 6 hours to 8 hours a day learning to play an instrument and learning music, but people who had at 18 or 19 or 20 years old, who at that point in time couldn't say, oh, I'm going to be a musician and play the Beethoven violin concerto. Can't do it. But this is the point where that 99% that didn't get that education, for whatever reason, could become literate and even creative with music. But they're going to be given the instruments of the past electronically. They're going to drag the past into it. I read for the first time before the book came out, his first book, Marshall McLuhan had done a lecture, and I had an excerpt from the lecture, several of us. And he said, we walk into the future backwards, looking through a rear view mirror. And I thought, when I looked around and talked to people, there were very few people who saw what was happening. And I thought, if I see what's happening, then I have an obligation to do the best I can to do what I think should be done and share it. I'm not there to change anything, but I must do that thing. And so I had to see if I had an aptitude for it. I made a big piece with electronics and images and lights and musicians and with speakers all around and the audience in the middle. I did that in 1961, and it was people went, it was in San Francisco, and people, I didn't know everyone was going to be on drugs in 3 years, or maybe they already were, I don't know. But it was a quite a sensation, and the San Francisco Chronicle wrote it, a new art form has been born, and I thought, well, it wasn't a very good piece, I never thought it to be done again, but I thought, well, I must have some aptitude. So I made the decision at that point to throw away the clarinet and dedicate myself to this new thing, doing the best I can with it, to make an example of what could be done. Whether anyone wanted it or not, I was going to share it with them. Whoever wanted it could do it and not. And 100 years from then, it would be when I thought this would all catch up. I didn't think I'd be standing here. I even didn't think I would be this old. But even this old, I thought it would take longer. But so I began my search. And the first thing that we did, I joined with Ramon Sender, a close friend of mine, and I gathered equipment, and I started to build a studio. It was made of automobile parts and things I could afford one tape recorder. And we joined, he had one oscillator, and so we put it together and we made a studio together. We found a house that a real estate person gave us to live in, to work, to make a studio out of. They were going to tear it down in a few years, and we could just use it. So we did that, and we tried to get some money, and called. Since I was playing with the San Francisco Symphony, I knew one of the patrons of the orchestra, and I called her. She had just bought a Stradivarius string quartet of instruments for either the Budapest Quartet or one of the big quartets. And I said, you know, Ramon and I are starting this thing. Could you send us some money? She said, oh, yes, no problem, but you have to become incorporated, nonprofit. So we spent $150 and became a nonprofit, and we had to have a name, so we called it the San Francisco Tape Music Center Incorporated, and she sent us a check for $25, and we put it on the wall. The building burned down with the check a year later, but in any case, that's how the San Francisco Tape Music Center started. We found another place, and we tried all. Ramon was going to help me with this new machine. I called it an electronic. I didn't call it a synthesizer. It was going to be an electronic music easel, and we came up with Ramon and I came up with an idea of using photosensitive light and wheels and holes in the wheels, and I put an ad in the paper to find an engineer who could build this thing. This was a model. I didn't think it would be that, but it was something to give the engineer some idea of what we were after, because if you put the wheel around and a light comes on it, the photocell, the faster it goes, the shape of the holes give you the timbre, and the speed of it goes around gives you the pitch. So that's, you know, that's the beginning. You could do anything you wanted. It was the idea of starting from scratch to make any kind of music. And several engineers came by. Most of them were on drugs. I didn't know that until later, but I thought the first guy his one eye went this way and the other one went that way, had a problem with his eyes. I didn't know he had a problem with his brain, and he did terrible things. He cut wires and we had to kick him out, and another engineer came and he was even worse. And then in walked Donald Buchla, who seemed to be normal and actually understood what we were talking about. And at the table we were at, drew this picture of the machine that would that would do what we said with the light and all of that stuff. He drew it out, and I didn't understand what it said. But and the next day he came back with it, with a little battery that ran the whole thing, and we put some holes and it ran, and it went, oh, and then if we went faster, it went, it was not very interesting, but it worked. And he said, but this isn't the way to do it. He said, and he introduced me to control voltage, to dyads, diodes, all the language. It was completely Greek to me. Not even Greek. I don't know, from another planet. I didn't know what he was talking about. But I was convinced he seems to know what he's doing. So we began, he and I began a 1.5 year voyage of creating the easel that was the machine that would allow for a composer, performer, whatever you want to call it, in a studio. I called it studio art, like a painter's art. And I used for the metaphor the palette and the brush and the canvas to create this new machine that someone could make anything they wanted with it, not perform in public. It was not a performance. It was a creative tool to make a new music, a music that starts from zero for people who never had a musical background, or if they had a musical background. But the truth is, I never thought that a person like myself, except me, because I want to, that's why I told you the story when I was 9, because a person like me who would have, from 5 years old, be doing music for 6 hours a day. By the time I got into upper school, I would be up in the wee hours of the morning, working 3 to 4 hours, composing, doing music theory, learning about music, go to school, sleep for 6 hours, and then come home and play the clarinet for 4 hours. Doing that for 15 years, and then giving it all up is not something most people would do, unless they had this book they read when they were 9 years old. So I never thought it would be people like me who would be doing it. It would be people who at 18 years old, 17 years old, or 20 years old or older, who didn't have a background on music, would have a machine that would be the new music. So we began working on that and that principle. One of the first things, these are the modules here that eventually came from the 100, but I'm not going to go through all of that unless you are particularly interested in it. The keyboard, so-called keyboard, was that's the keyboard, but it's not. I insisted that we not put a black and white keyboard into the system, because this keyboard is not a normal keyboard. It has no differentiation, black and white keys. It has no tuning whatsoever. It's simply a set of 16 touch plate. They're actually resistance, but if you press your finger harder, it makes more. It makes more electricity pass, and so they're like a capacitor, and so you can get more energy, more electricity comes through if it's a light touch or a heavy touch, and where you go on the up and down on the key transfers another kind of electricity. So it's the idea of the metaphor of the brush was. The brush is part of your hand, so I wanted an input that was like a brush, like a part of the hand, and that's what these 16 keys are. And then they had outputs from each one that could go to different modules in the system independently, or all of them if you wanted. Because always I wanted always that anything you did could be a normal piece of music if you wanted, but it had the capacity no more easy, in fact harder, to make a normal piece than something brand new from scratch that no one ever made before and in a different way. I'll go over here. This is me in my studio on Bleecker Street. By the time the booklet got finished, I was ready to move on to New York. I was invited to New York to do several things. So I brought the Buchla to New York. The San Francisco Tape Music Center still has the original. This is a duplicate of it that I went with. This is my studio in New York. I'll come back to that in a minute. But in my studio in New York, I had developed, let me keep track of time here. Okay. I developed, I would do, because of my background of traditional music, by the way, by the time I got to New York, I not only gave up the clarinet, the week before I left, I played the Brahms clarinet quintet with a famous string quartet at the time in public. And before that, I was on television doing a live performance. In the television show, I was playing a piece by composer Starts with clarinet. I knew I was going to give up the clarinet as soon as I was done. When I got to New York, I was going to have enough money to live on without the clarinet. And so I was not going to play anymore. But I wasn't leaving for 2 weeks. So I still had the clarinet. And I was playing this piece, and it starts off with a little passage that goes, boop, it's clarinet solo. In comes the camera, because in those days you never rehearsed with the camera ahead of time. So the television didn't know I was going to do this. So it comes in, and it caught my attention. And I, corner of my eye, I could see a man standing at a pillar about that far away, leaning with his arms folded like this, wearing a white T-shirt and Levi's. And I was in a and tails and tuxedo playing the clarinet on television. I don't know how many people were watching. And the guy over there was me in a white T-shirt and jeans. And he's laughing. He's saying, what are you, I won't give you the words he used, but you four-letter words, it started with an F. What are you doing? You look like a snake charmer going around in circles like that, like you really love what you're doing. You don't even like that piece of music. He said, what are you doing that for? And I said, you got to be quiet because we are in front of a lot of people. And if you don't stop, I'm going to stand up and scream and we'll be carried away to an insane asylum. He didn't stop. And we got into this screaming argument, the two of us. All of a sudden, the lights come up. All I remember was playing deep, da-da-dum-bup. The lights come up, and I thought, I'm going to be taken away. I look down, and I'm drenched. I'm just drenched with perspiration. You could squeeze the tuxedo, and water, tears, whatever it is that comes out of your body, would come with it. And the violinist stood up, and I looked, and he didn't seem upset. And so I said, Nate, I said, how did it go? And he said, what? I said, how did the performance go? He said, what do you mean? He said, it went fine. And I thought, I ran into they always did a cover tape for us. And I said, quick, because we're going to do the Brahms next. And I said, quick, play me a little. And it sounded great. So almost a perfect, and I don't remember a note that I played on it. So when I got on the stage the two nights later to do the Brahms, I was just petrified that I would lose it in front of a live audience, but I didn't. Managed to get through. Went to the post office to send all of our books and everything to New York, and then I gave them my clarinet case, and I said, this, and I want the books there, I said, as fast as possible, Air Express or whatever you can do. Then I handed this separate box that had the clarinet in it, and I said, this I would like you to send through the Panama Canal. I don't want to see it for at least 4 months arriving to my house. And it did. It I don't know if they sent it, but it came snail mail, and it arrived maybe 2 months later. And I never opened it again. I that's a lie. I did once or twice over a period of 10 years, and then I never opened it again until about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when Terry Riley's In C was going to be done, and I had actually been one of the people to ask him to write a piece that we could all play with, 1964, just before I left for New York, that was in C and played in it. And when they did it in Carnegie Hall, they wanted me to play as part of it because I was the beginning of it. And so I had my clarinet case for whatever many years that is, sitting at a diagonal on my studio in New York like that, you know, in front of me. I never opened it, but it was there. And so about 3 days, I said I would do it. You know, I hadn't played in 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. But I, you know, NC is easy, so I could do that. I opened up the case about 2 days before, and there was nothing in it. I have no idea where it went, but there was no clarinet in the case all that time. And I did find it later. I had bought a new case for it, put it in there, and I'd forgotten and left the old case just sitting there. But I had to borrow a clarinet, so I did play the clarinet again once in C at Carnegie Hall. That's a good story, right? Because people are dying to play in Carnegie Hall, and I had to borrow my old clarinet to get in there and play. Anyway, I took, at that point in time, I took my name and my biography, never included the clarinet, not until about 10 years ago I put it back in again. And I'm sharing it because I think that's important that people understand that. But the reason I didn't want it is I was anxious to be part of sharing with someone the idea of not simply getting what someone's giving you, which is an old instrument with electronics, but an opportunity to start where you are and not have to go. If you get a black and white keyboard, you're going to run into the same problems any pianist had. You don't have 10 fingers. You've got 8 fingers. The 2 thumbs don't reach the keyboard. So you have to spend the first 3-4 years, you know, learning how to get your thumb up there. I mean it's actually not an empowerment to add a black and white keyboard for someone who's never played music. It's actually a limiting factor. But I'm not going to lecture that. That's what someone will find out. So I didn't want my background at that point to be, oh, but he played the clarinet and he did all this stuff, and so you can't just make music with this thing. You have to do it, you know, go back and learn music. I didn't want people to think that. I didn't want to say I didn't know, but I didn't want to intimidate I wanted it to have its own power that it could go. And so we went forward. I had the Buchla. This is something like what it looked like originally. And of course, I'm in my studio on Bleecker Street, and I didn't know that, I didn't keep track of the new album. I mean, this is 1966, 65 and 66. The Beatles didn't come into the United States until 64. I didn't know in those 2 years that the world had been taken over by, I knew that they were famous, you know, but I didn't pay much attention. I didn't know the world had been taken over by a new set of pop musicians that had come into being, the Grateful Dead and all this, and all the people that were there. So I had my studio on Bleecker Street, which happened to be the center of everything that was going on in New York. They were all playing within a block of where my studio was. And I worked it late at night because I had 2 kids that I had to take care of, and I was up during the daytime, but when they went to bed I had a woman come in, and I would come to my studio, and it was a block away, and I would work all night and get back, play a Brandenburg concerto, a vinyl thing, and get myself in the mood to wake my children up and give them breakfast and say, you know, all the things you're supposed to say to get them off to school. And so I was in my studio one of the nights, and every night there'd be different people would come in. They were from the bands, getting off 2 o'clock in the morning, and they'd come, many of them would come in, and I had an old sofa and they would sit in it. And I talk to them sometimes, people from the Grateful Dead and people from Andy Warhol's group. They would all sort of come in. They heard there was this madman with all these wires and things doing these strange things at night. And they would just walk in to be part of it. The door was always open, so they just came in. And I never really had a long conversation with anyone, and I kept my work going. And I was giving lectures, public lectures, to help the income. And my public lecture was something like the new medium in music is the phonograph record. And because we now had long playing, good quality, virtual reality sound, For the first time in history, so you could play more than 3 minutes on the side of a record. You could play 15 minutes on the side of a record, and so you could actually have real music. And I said, he said, the new instrument, the new medium is the phonograph record, and it's the new. It will be the new chamber music. It will replace. For people who didn't play the piano, they will be able to have their own chamber music, which will be records. And record companies and people and the general public will rise up and saying it is unethical and immoral to hire musicians to play to record music that was intended for people to play in front of people, and that they will commission new works for the new medium to have a new music for the new medium chamber music. I knew this would never happen, but. Again, because of my 9-year-old experience, I had to say what I believed to be true and share it, and so I did in public. One night, I don't remember the names of the people, but there were two or three people sitting in the sofa with a typical 60s serious conversation that went, you probably never heard one, but it went, oh, oh, oh. That was the vocabulary approximately going on at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on that sofa. And in walks this guy in a suit, and he gives me my lecture. He gives me almost word for word. I'm talking about immorality and unethical. He said, I'm the head of this record company, and he gives me the name, which was an outlandish name. And I thought he was making fun of me, that he had been at one of my lectures and was coming in and dressing up and making fun of me, that he thought it was really stupid what I was saying. And he said, and we've decided to give you $500 to do this. And that was a lot of money in those days. I practically pushed him. I said, please leave and I don't want to see you ever again. And so he left. The next morning, I went to play my Brandenburg Concerto, and it was Nonesuch Records. The only reason I bought it was cheap, and I tried calling all day long. I couldn't find Nonesuch in the telephone book, so I thought, I just blew it. I mean, this guy was real. I get in at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he enters again, and I'm about to get on my knees and say, I'll do it for nothing, and he says, don't send me away. Just listen. He said, we met all day today, and we've decided to offer you $1,000. And I said, I'll take it. And that was the commission for Silver Apples of the Moon. And so that was actually 13 months before it was released in September 1967. So that would have been whenever that 13 months was. It was, I think, sometime in 1966. I worked for 13 months and I got it done. And of course, when it came out, the Moog didn't exist yet in a form that anyone could use. He had not made an integrated system yet. I knew Moog, and I knew early modules he was making, but this was. There may have been something else. I don't know. No one has ever shown anything else. This seems to be the first full-bodied, whatever you want to call it. And so there was no other experience, and this record came out, and it was immediately successful. It reached the top 10 in the charts of classical music, and I was a celebrity almost overnight. It was completely overwhelming to me. Excited. In fact, I wanted to buy my record. I went into a record store to buy my record. I said, I heard there's this record by this guy, Morton Subotnick. I'd like to buy it. He said, yeah, we keep running out. I don't know why they buy this thing. They just come in and they just go out as soon as they come in. He said, it's really not, I won't give you the word he used. Well, it's crap, he said. I'll give you some real music. I said, no, it's okay. I walked in a giant and I walked out a dwarf of that place. But in any case, it was a big hit. I was invited twice to the Johnny Carson show, which I didn't do either time. And the William Morris Agency came and said, we'll make you famous and rich. And I said, I love being famous and I'd love being rich, but what do I have to do? Oh, nothing, they said. We just just what, do what you do and we'll make you famous and rich. I said, come on, there's got to be a catch somewhere. And I pretty soon I got caught the idea. I said, oh, wait a minute, you're going to tell me the right clothes to wear. Oh, yeah, we'll keep your wardrobe done. And you'll tell me which parties I should go to. And oh, yeah, we'll organize your social life. I said, I thought so. You got the wrong person. You can take it away. And that was the end of that. So I produced this piece on this machine. And I'm a celebrity. So now I'm out a year or so later, about a year and a half later, I'm out touring Kansas. That's because I wasn't allowed to go to, the CIA wouldn't let me to go. I was invited to Russia, but CIA wouldn't let me go because I was a risk. Because it was 1968, and in those days, the CIA was, America wasn't open like it is now. So we're going right back to it. But in any case, I couldn't go to Russia. So I was going next best. I was touring Kansas in the middle of the country, doing three lectures a day. And every time I'd go somewhere, there would be someone running to get to my lecture. And I stopped this one person. I said, where are you going? I'm going to that lecture on electronic. I love electronic music. And I'm thinking, there's nothing there. What could she could like? Must be Silver Apples of the Moon. So I said, what did you hear? Oh, Switched on Bach, which I didn't know was even out. And then it occurred to me, Moog had finished his synthesizer, and someone had played and recorded Bach. And that's what I was so happy. At that moment, I was so happy that I was right. That, you know, but I got Silver Apples done first. Otherwise, it would have been buried. It would have been buried in the rubble of commercialism. So that it would be there for people to see an alternative. That the keyboard had arrived and people loved it because they had done something that people understood and wanted. So I walked in and I gave the lecture, and people had heard about Silver Apples of the Moon. It's just that they didn't own it, and it was really Switched on Bach that they came for. But nevertheless, I gave my talk, and one of them, at one point, when they said, I was toward the end of the lecture, and I had questions, yeah, who are you? And I said, I'm sorry? Who are you? And I said, I'm Morton Subotnick. You're Morton Subotnick. Oh, I thought he was dead. It was like, if there's a record, Bach was dead. Must be Morton Subotnick is dead too. Anyway, that was the beginning of it. So here's what the world, 1967, I mean, Switched on Bach was 1968. So here's what the world got from Silver Apples of the Moon. We need a little more volume, I think. Well, that's okay. Let me get a little louder. Okay, that's what they get from Silver Apples of the Moon. And then what they get from Switched on Bach is this. So it tells the story. That's why I was actually relieved when I knew about Switched on Bach, because not that it's bad, it's wonderful to be able to play such great music on you know, with electronics. It's wonderful. There's no problem with that. But it was exactly as I had predicted. We'd not only I wanted a new music. I didn't want to have a new old music. But we didn't even get new old music. We got old music on a new machine, and that's where the real trajectory went. It went in that direction from that point on. My work, I continued without worrying. This was not a Switched on Bach. The date here is when he built it. Ours was built 64. And then I had this studio on Bleecker Street, and I kept working. There was lots of pictures here. And at a certain point in the first years or so, the idea of, and this If you went to the concert, you would have heard when I'm about, you wouldn't hear this music, but the concept. I was really energized. One, I didn't go in the Johnny Carson, I didn't get rich and famous, but I had made my mark so that whatever I did from that point on, I would live up to my promise of the 9-year-old kid, that I could keep going and share. It was modest, but it was good enough to keep going. And so I kept going, and I took it to the next step of the metaphor of the easel, of trying to get more input that would be gestural. That's a gesture. It's not a stamp. It's not C. It's how, here's C. Oh. It's actually not that, it's dung. Now here's another C. Oh. If you have a violin, a beautiful violin, a Stradivarius violin, and you bow one note, that one bowing could cause people to cry. It's so beautiful. It could cause them to die if it's so ugly. It's the way in which you move, the gesture that makes the meaningfulness in music, not just a note being hit. So I was on the right track, but I realized there was another element missing that we had left out, and that was, I can't do that with my finger, but I can do it with my mouth. So I called 1968, I called Don Buchla on the phone. I gave him this, what I just did over the phone, from New York to San Francisco. He was a very quiet man. He never said anything, so there was quiet at the other end. He said, I can make something like that. So he sent me, a couple of weeks later, he sent me, I think it was very shortly after, a module that converted my voice, the amplitude of my voice, into control. It's called an envelope follower. Now it's a standard module that you'll find in all kinds of places, but the sensitivity was incredible. And so here's an example of early in the early 70s. This comes from, but it's and you could move it from side to side and do everything you wanted with it. Here's what it sounds like with electronics. So, whoops, sorry. So what it's working from is a recording of my voice doing just what I did, and then translating it after the fact, taking leader tape on either part, so it's standing by itself, and then patching the entire Buchla, and it takes me the length of time that you heard this to make the recording, but then it takes the next 2 to 3 weeks of patching every piece in the studio together to make my voice make all these things happen at one time. And then when you take the leader away and go to the next one, you've got this continuous, the continuum of a live performance of my voice over maybe 10 minutes being translated into day by day, with leader between each phrase, into a piece of music. So the labor was extremely intensive, but the result is extremely intuitive. I mean, with a sense of human, it's the easel. It's that thing going. And I last night I used now a wind controller, because if I use my voice, you're going to hear it in the auditorium. I don't want you to hear my voice. I want you to hear the results of the voice. So I can do it now because they make equipment that allows you to do that by just blowing the early wind followers would never do that. I won't get into that because they were thinking you were doing something else. The new ones actually are very good, and you can do exactly what I did with my voice with the new wind followers. So the breath controllers. And so I was doing things like that last night, and I was doing them in real time. You were getting them when I wanted them. And if I go, thuck, then you hear, thuck. If I go, it goes, and it's also moving it in space, both my hand and the thing. So everything is happening in real time. But I couldn't do anything like that in real time, and it had to be done with patches that would go in the studio and complete. But that gives you a good example, I think the best example, those things I just showed you, of the direction that I was trying to share with people, a direction that was not piano-based, not old music-based. When I say old, I don't mean bad. I mean before this moment, before the moment of the Big Bang, the technological Big Bang, to be able to bring, in fact, because I use the metaphor of the printing press. The printing press is what the printing press did is it brought the recording, it brought the early writing from Sumeria, 7,000-9,000 years ago, and what the term etched in stone was literally true. They were keeping track of how much people owned and kept it in stone, and so that at the end of the year they could collect taxes from these people. So there was a record of how much people had. It had nothing to do with how they felt about what they owned or how they felt about the taxes. So when the printing press came, it brought the language as etched in stone, but not the oral tradition. So if I say to you, do you like what you do? You could answer yes, no. But if I say to you, do you like what you do? Then you can't answer it yes, no, because there's some kind of, do you like what you do? When you write it, you can't write it other than do you like what you do, question mark. So how do you get that information from a page? You can't. Only by writing more. You'd have to write a paragraph, maybe a novel, depending on what you're doing and why you don't like it or why you do like it. So that same thing was happening in music. If you go to the old tradition of music, which is keyboards and that, you're going to be playing music as we knew it. You can't get to the new. What we could do with the new technology is what I was trying to demonstrate. You could have a new vocabulary which is based on gesture. The musician, the instruments, the music that was written for instruments was like the old stone that said how much do they have. How you feel about it could only be said when you came to collect it. The people would say, no, no, you're going to make me poor. Or, oh boy, let's take all that stuff. All the stuff that you would say in real life is not in the record. And so it suddenly that oral tradition is gone. So what I was trying to do is to get the body gestural that made the music, because the composers would write, it'd be the musicians who made that violin make you cry because it was so beautiful. It wasn't the person who wrote C, it was the person who played it that did it. So the music of Beethoven was a template for people to play. If they play it badly, you would hate it. If they play it beautifully, it could be beautiful. That was missing from what was going to happen if you went just the direction that the instrumentation was taking you at that point. You could make interesting things, but they wouldn't have that possibility. Only if you can get at the instrument without the keyboard and just playing notes, or some kind of input device that would allow you, even knobs or sliders, give you more input information than playing a C on a piano. So that I shared, and I'm still alive, and I'm still sharing it. I shared it live now, which I couldn't do then, and on record. So that's my talk. So any questions? Thank you. That was pretty good. That was about, I guess, what is that? It's actually more. If I go back to 9 years old, we're talking about a lot of years. At least 50 years in 50 minutes. That wasn't bad. Any questions?
Thank you. It's so fascinating to hear from this perspective that everything was happening in Bleecker Street, but this phenomenon with like electronics was happening all over the world, like obviously in like Europe and the UK. Did you have any contact, for example, with like the European Electronic Workshop or with the BBC Radiophonic, and did that influence in any sort of way the things you composed and the material that you made?
I was very aware of, it was a very small world. There were about 20 of us, so we all knew each other. I knew the studio in Holland and the Stockhausen I knew, and the Cologne studio. The Princeton seminar, the Princeton large Mark II, you know, which is a huge digital machine. The early work of Stockhausen were the studies, and those were basically new old music. They were basically, you know, pitch-based. He was thinking about intervals you could do and the amplitude and all of that. It wasn't until the Gesang that he actually broke from that. But the early music was still new old music from the entire crowd. They were the only people. The people who made the break were the Schaefer, the Music Concrete people. They were thinking radio, and radio drama. So they were thinking it not as the old fine art. They were redefining from that standpoint. And the reason we called it San Francisco Tape Music Center, there was a big battle in those days between the pure Cologne studio and the French radio, which said you can't bring a microphone. Cologne said you can't bring a microphone in. Stockhausen had said he had to, for the Gesang, he had to actually do it in the middle of the night so you could get a microphone in there for someone to actually record. And in the French studio, you couldn't bring an oscillator in. I mean, it was like this thing. So we said, we'll call it the San Francisco Tape. Anything on tape is music. So, you know, that was the way around it. So one of the things when I said that people didn't seem to realize what this really meant in terms of what's going to happen. It wasn't the fine art music that was going to be projected. It was a new thing. And those were the examples that made me say, even people like Stockhausen and so forth were still thinking fine art music being done with electronics. And I was thinking the generation that's about to be born are going to grow up with an instrument that, if they're not careful, they won't even be able to play. If we bring old instruments into the future, so and that's the generation, and they would be just as illiterate as, or not as, but they wouldn't be empowered, especially empowered if they did it that way. So yeah, it was part of my thinking that this was the fine art. And it's very interesting because electronic music as such in the fine art world really didn't go anywhere. I mean, it's around, but it's the pop world that we have now, the avant-garde of the pop world that's really come about. And that's exactly what I had imagined. I am so fulfilled to think that I lived to see it actually happen and to hear what it actually turned out to be. Not that I like it all, but that I happened. Yeah. Thank you. Did we set it? Okay. We have no more questions. Thank you.